There are three times as many Chinese restaurants in this country as there are McDonald's, but at one point they were almost outlawed because of a Chicago effort.
So if you wanted to be free from the strict laws of society at that time, you went to a Chinese restaurant.
That's WBEZ Chicago and Chewing Podcast co-host Monica Ng. Her co-host, the Chicago Tribune's Louisa Chu. Take us out for Chop Suey and Egg Foo Young to discuss the history of Chinese restaurants in the Midwest. Plus, it's Friday. Let's go to the movies. Illinois movies, I should say.
Bueller. Bueller. Bueller.
He's sick.
Thank you, Simone.
We hear about a new list to celebrate Illinois' most popular movies as the state celebrates its 200th anniversary. That's all coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to this special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Back in March, I sat down with food writers and radio hosts Monica Ng from WBEZ Chicago and Louisa Chu from the Chicago Tribune. They both co-host the podcast Chewing, and they've also both grew up in Chicago in the world of Chinese restaurants. As you'll hear in a minute, both Monica and Louisa's families owned and operated Chinese restaurants, and both journalists recently wrote pieces about their food heritage for the Chicago Tribune. So I thought I'd invite them to sit down to eat at a quintessential Chinese-American spot to talk about the different styles of Chinese cuisine, whether or not chop suey is authentic, and of course, what makes a good egg roll. Here we are at Lee's Chop Suey, which opened in 1968 in Chicago's Logan Square neighborhood. What are we going to get?
Well, I'm thinking definitely some chop suey, chow mein, egg foo young, and maybe even sweet and sour pork. What do you guys think?
I for sure need to get the egg rolls because they are the classic, what I'm calling Chicago-style Midwestern egg rolls with peanut butter in the ingredients. Fried shrimp for sure, which I'm guessing is going to be like the sort of puffy, breaded Cantonese fried shrimp. So far, those are my main things, but yeah.
Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, so you have regular egg roll, three of it, one vegetable egg roll, and one shrimp fried rice, and one graham corn, which is the six pieces, mushroom egg foo young, and one shrimp fried rice, which is small size, and one chicken chow mein, which is a crispy one, and also the Chinese chop suey. So the egg foo young is mushroom egg foo young. So,
right. Okay.
That be all?
I think that's
yes.
A lot of food.
Okay. All right.
So Monica Ng and Louisa Chu are here. Can both of you share, Monica, do you want to start the story of your family's Chinese restaurant in Chicago?
Sure. Actually, my great-grandpa, Joe Ng, came to Quincy, Illinois, which has been in the news lately, in about 1909. He had laundries there and then came to Chicago and started opening restaurants. He had some takeout joints in East Garfield Park, as well as a giant, world's largest Chinese cafe called the Golden Pumpkin, also in East Garfield Park, where he had jazz bands and three stories of restaurants until 1929, and he lost it all in the Great Depression and started up again in 1933 with Hosai Gai, House of Ang, a bunch of other restaurants in the Chicago area and Chicago.
Louisa, what about your family?
So can I first say that Monica always seems to downplay the fact that her family's restaurants were a dynasty, that she is a descendant, albeit perhaps undeserving, of this incredible restaurant dynasty.
No.
Hosai Gai was unlike and perhaps will be unlike any other Chinese restaurant in history. It was this spectacular Art Deco masterpiece, which the building is completely torn down, is now Daley Plaza here in Chicago. And you can still see pictures of postcards online. I mean, and they each had themed rooms, each one which was more exquisite than the other. Later on, the Empire included some of these most spectacular, also tiki cocktail restaurants, which had one of the restaurants had one of the first Asian key clubs, which were modeled after the Playboy rooms
of
a different era.
Basically, you could be entertained by women,
right.
Very beautiful women. Mm. One of our restaurants was pretty much two doors down from the Playboy Club on Walton. And my relatives were seeing these long lines outside the Playboy Club and saying, hey, why not have some gorgeous ladies at our place, too? So we had Hung Fa Village, which specialized in that. We had the Key Clubs in the House of Angs, too.
So we're at Lee's Chop Suey. What kind of style Chinese restaurant would you characterize this as?
Rec room.
This old school.
This is like late 1960s, 1970s era, dark wood paneling, rec room, kind of, you know, with
red lanterns, yep. Chinese art.
Can you explain what Cantonese style restaurants would be like?
So my family restaurants were chop suey, Cantonese style chop suey, which really came around during the same time that these did, you know, late 1960s, 1970s, where they served some of the classic mid-century modern chop suey, chow mein, Hong Kong steak. Also then started to add in, though, pan-fried noodles, because that was actually sort of a more, I should say, late-era Cantonese introduction to Chicago-style Midwestern Chinese restaurants. Mild sauces, it is generally...
Not to be confused with mild sauce on Chicago's south side that you get in places like Harold's. Different.
Completely different. But
Or a tea's coming. And then Lazy Susan is a must. We have a Lazy Susan in the middle of the table.
The Chinese chop suey, which is the barbecue pot mixed with the vegetables.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you. Needs hot tea on a cold night like tonight.
So there's actually a little bit of an evolution too, because these chop suey restaurants really did start out by serving Chinese American but Cantonese style food, whereas now there's now a next generation of Cantonese style food, which is serving foods that you will find in the southern coastal region of Guangdong, previously known as Canton, and Hong Kong style food. So, for example, in Chicago, Ming Hin is a restaurant that serves Cantonese kai or chai. Also in Chinatown serves what I call fancy Cantonese, with these big banquet rooms and dim sum, and you know, so
elaborate
there's
seafood dishes,
yeah, where they have like the 26 course
right.
Lunar New Year
abalone.
Meals. So would you consider, and I don't know if this is the right word, do you consider this authentic, or what word would you use?
Well, there's been a lot of debate over that. And what I say is, when a cuisine's been around for more than, let's say, 115 years, it's a real cuisine. Is it exactly what our ancestors ate in Canton? Probably not.
It's really hard. We actually just published a guide to Chinatown, and I addressed the question of authentic, because we know what people mean. And I wrote about that and said, you know, I know what you mean. And for lack of a better word yet, we're going to use authentic, you know, but yeah.
So by authentic, we mean not American? Is that what that's what people mean when they say authentic?
They don't want
things that have an American style or influence?
When I hear authentic, I think this is what people from this country ate back home.
But I think that it's such a broad general term when it comes to food. I mean, it's like there's authentic African-American food, which is clearly of this country and was nothing like, or actually very little like African food. But it's clearly a cuisine that is of this country. And as far as time is concerned, I mean, we have now a lot of dishes that were created here that have a shorter lifespan. I mean, I think about like sort of a lot of the mashups, like Mexican snack foods and street foods, which were developed out of a lot of the, you know, streets and street foods and bodegas here in the U.S. So authentic is a tough one, you know. I don't know. We don't know what the better word is for that, but like real, genuine, authentic. We know what you mean. I have a tough time with what's authentic or not.
But if you're asking, is this what people ate in Canton before they left? Nope, not what we ate. Let's say with egg rolls. I did a story for the Tribune about these chubby cabbage and shrimp and pork plus peanut butter egg rolls. And I asked my great aunt, Fanny Go, is this the kind of thing you ate when you were in Canton? She said there was nothing like this there. If you had anything sort of like it, it was the spring roll, a thin little delicate roll that they would serve during the spring festival, also known as Chinese New Year.
The egg rolls are coming.
Speak of the devil, here they are. Look at these gorgeous,
these are beautiful,
blistered, golden, chubby things. All right, and the sauce is so usually in the United States, you get sweet and sour sauce plus a mustard sauce made with Coleman's English mustard. How Cantonese is that? Well, because the British were in China.
Thank you.
Oh, what is that?
Oh, that's a fried shrimp.
Oh, that's a shrimp. They look like little donuts.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay. And this is
the crab rangoon.
Yes.
Okay, so this is, I feel like, our fried course has come. Who wants to tell us history of where egg rolls came from then?
Okay, so you don't see egg rolls on menus until, I'd say, mid-century. And actually, it was thought that these types of egg rolls were created in New York and then came here. Louisa likes to refer to them as Midwest style. I don't know. But what you see in China is something called a spring roll, much more slender and delicate with a thinner wrapper served at the Spring Festival, also known as Lunar New Year. Crab Rangoon, 1956, Trader Vic's. I recently had someone tell me that he invented it in Saginaw, Michigan in the 70s, but you can't fool historical documents. Trader Vic's was one of the tiki restaurants that grew up out of the post-World War II era when all the GIs were coming home. They'd been exposed to Polynesia and South Pacific. The musical had come out, and everybody was thinking about these exotic girls and these exotic umbrella drinks. And so my great uncle and my grandfather opened up a restaurant on Randolph right next to the Oriental Theater called South Pacific. Trader Vic's was a restaurant in the Palmer House.
Did everybody try the egg roll?
Not yet.
Louisa.
I know.
They wanted to come up with all of these exotic dishes. So they had these flaming dishes, these poo-poo platters, and crab rangoon was one of the dishes that came out of it, and it sounds very, very exotic.
All right, I'm going to try the egg roll first.
What's the verdict?
What's the verdict? It is a good one. I like how the strands of cabbage still have a little bit of crunch in them. Sometimes some of the newer ones are completely really fine cut or almost a paste in the middle. A pretty good fry in these. Really nice distinctive savory tone from the peanut butter, which is noticeable but not too overwhelming. I've had
Why peanut butter?
Nyla, that is the eternal question.
You said this is the 12th egg roll you've had in the past week.
Actually, this might be the 12th place. So I've had a lot of egg rolls.
And how far have you gone in this egg roll quest? Where have you gone?
So far, the biggest trip that I took on hitting the egg roll trail, I went out west and drove about 200 miles round trip out to DeKalb and Rockford. In DeKalb, there's a restaurant called Pho and Grill. And then in Rockford, there is a restaurant called Lung Fung Number 2. It's very important to distinguish that it's the number 2 in Rockford. And both of those restaurants have egg rolls that are descendants of the Pekin House restaurant in Chicago on Devon Avenue, closed in 2012, I believe it was. One of the two sort of most beloved long-lost egg rolls in the Chicago area. Very different, though. Pekin House was closer to the egg rolls here at Lee's, which is more sort of like the classic golden, somewhat the similar style of the familiar tubular Chinese-American appetizer, whereas Cow Cow was very different because it was batter dipped before it was double fried.
And then you were explaining why peanut butter?
So that's the big existential question. Why is there peanut butter? It is this question about cultural identity. I've heard a lot of different theories, some that peanut butter was used to seal the wrappers, others that it was used as a binding ingredient, that it was a filler during World War II rationing time, and others simply because it was just for flavoring. So I tracked down the man that I thought invented the Chinese-American, what I call the Chicago-style egg roll of peanut butter, and can't tell you yet, Nyla. I'm sorry.
You just heard some of the conversation I had with Louisa Chu and Monica Ng over dinner back in March at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago. We'll share some pictures of our meal over social media. We also have been asking you to tell us about your favorite Chinese restaurant in your part of the state. Tori wrote on Facebook that, quote, best egg rolls are from Grand's Cafe in Bloomington. The original Grand Cafe closed, but they moved to Grand Cafe Express on Oakland Avenue. And she added, yes, they're made with peanut butter. Want to tell us about your fave? Tweet us or talk to us on Facebook at 21STShow. We'll be back in a minute here on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Nyla, my name is Barbara. I heard you were doing a show on Chinese food, and I graduated from the U of I, and when I go back there to visit, I always like to go to Bobo China. I really enjoy the Mongolian lamb and their stir-fried beef with the rice noodles. Thanks a lot. Great show. Bye.
Hi, my name is Matthew from Bloomington, Illinois, and I'm calling about my favorite Chinese restaurant, the Orient Gourmet. I think it is classic Chinese food done really well. Their crab rangoon is my go-to appetizer. The beef with broccoli is my go-to main dish. And just about everything else is really, really good. So I'm recommending the Orient Gourmet. Thanks and great show.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in. And today we're bringing you a fun conversation I had with Chicago Tribune food writer Louisa Chu and WBEZ reporter Monica Ng. These two know their Chinese food and their Chinese-American history, and so I invited them out to eat at Lee's Chop Suey in Chicago's Northwest Side. We'll tweet out links to articles that Monica and Louisa have written about this, and this is a conversation on their podcast, Chewing, but let's get back to our conversation.
This is the crispy noodle. This is supposed to go on top of the chop suey?
So traditionally, that is the old school. The good thing is that that's the old school chow mein noodles, and people will recognize it as being like I was saying, looks like fried pieces of spaghetti.
Louisa, do you know the difference between Chinese chop suey, fine cut chop suey, and regular chicken chop suey?
I've never had chop suey or egg fuya.
I'm guessing that the fine cut pork chop suey is going to be different than like what is considered a classic American or Midwestern style pork chop suey, which is like usually chunks. So like the really classic old school mid-century modern chop suey was chunks of pork and celery.
Actually, chop suey was served in all of the cafeterias of downtown Chicago at the beginning of the 20th century. Fritzl's had it. Basically, every cafeteria in a school would serve chop suey every week. It was a very American thing.
Right, but the thing is, I'm not sure that that chop suey was similar to the mid-century chop suey, because, you know, so...
Was that just cabbage and meat?
Celery and meat and bean sprouts.
Chop suey can mean so many different things, and that's kind of what is sort of delightful about it, is that it is conceptually pretty amazing and pretty ingenious and inventive. As far as how they make it here, we'll have to find out.
I am happy to be both Chinese and American.
You are like the Chinese dish the Americans invented. What do they call it?
Chop suey.
That is it. Everything is in it, all mixed up.
I like that. Chop suey, chop suey. Living here is very much like chop suey. Hula hoops and nuclear war, Dr. Salk and Jar Jar Gabor, Bobby Darin, Sandra D and Dewey. Chop suey.
Chop suey.
So now I'm trying my first egg foo young.
So actually, I just wrote a mushroom egg foo young and mushroom gravy recipe for the Trib, which I'm very relieved that a lot of people wrote in and said that they were excited to try it and made it and really loved it, because it does hit a very specific, again, taste memory. So typically, egg foo young can be traced back to, again, we think the Canton, Guangdong region of southern coastal China, which I should add is, I often say, it's kind of like the New Orleans area of the U.S. and has a reputation as having some of the best food in China. And you'll find, actually, variations of egg foo young, this kind of omelet or frittata, if you will, throughout Asia. It's not just a Chinese-American thing. You'll find it in other hybrid Cantonese-Asian foods. And so typically in Chinese-American restaurants, the way we used to make it is that you mixed your ingredients together. Typically, the main ingredients were egg and bean sprouts. And then in a ladle, lowered into a big, deep, hot wok full of oil, and then it would bubble up. It bubbles up like a souffle. Then it gets all crispy and golden brown in the outside. It should still stay a little tender on the inside. And then the gravy, my recipe, which actually is at the Trib, it's super easy. And so basically what you take is either fresh shiitake or portobello mushrooms, which are really common now, which was not so common in the mid-century or late mid-century foods when these came up, and you saute those first. You season as you go along, you taste them. You add fresh bean sprouts and some egg, some scallions. You whip that up until it's frothy, and then in the bottom of a round bottom wok, you add, you know, a fair amount, like maybe 3 tablespoons or so of like either coconut oil or peanut oil, and then you let it bubble up and fry until it gets all nice and lacy and crispy around the edges. And then when it just barely sets on the bottom, you flip it over. And so it's not necessarily the round puffed patty that a lot of restaurants will achieve, because they have the benefit of the big, giant, deep woks full of oil. But I could not reasonably ask people to put like 2 gallons of oil or so into a wok. So you can do this actually with just like, you know, a round bottom wok. Or I heard back from people who use like an electric skillet. Just use a fair amount of oil. And then you just flip it, and then also the gravy. And it's just simply a matter of seasoning enough with salt, pepper, soy sauce, and really not much more else. And it just makes a huge difference. Salt just makes a huge difference. It's really not that much more. Mine isn't so much necessarily a classic roux as much as it is a flour-based sauce rather than a cornstarch-based sauce. So mine, again, starts with sautéed mushrooms and then some flour, and also then a little additional fat in the form of either, again, coconut oil or peanut oil. Then that is essentially your roux base for your sauce. And then you add vegetable stock into it, and then you mix that up. And then you will have a little bit of like a slightly chunky mushroom-flecked gravy. And it's just a really simple sauce.
Chow mein and bowling, Twinkies and champagne. McDonald's, frozen pizza in the rain.
Okay, here's my question, Monica. You wrote a story recently for the Chicago Tribune. We've been here talking. We're at a Chinese restaurant. We're enjoying the food. You wrote a really interesting story about the history of how, even though Chinese restaurants are more common, there's three times more Chinese restaurants in the U.S. than there are McDonald's. I learned that by reading your story.
Yes.
At one point in time, that almost was not the case, and it was because Chicago tried to outlaw them.
Yeah, there was a group of strange bedfellows, labor unions that represented servers and bartenders, and Chicago legislators and state legislators across the nation were kind of freaked out by all the Chinese in the United States. And Chinese restaurants also weren't unionized. So they actually got some legislation pretty far. I mean, it was passed that would outlaw white women from entering Chinese restaurants, that would forbid restaurant licenses to anybody who wasn't who couldn't be naturalized and Chinese could not become citizens, so basically no Chinese restaurants, and that would stop Chinese from, say, opening restaurants or even doing any construction in certain parts of Chicago.
And when was this?
We're talking about 1909-ish. Up until about 1915, all these things were pretty much going strong.
People don't realize that's actually the origin of American immigration law, was to bar Chinese people from coming to this country. Those were like the first immigration laws that were ever passed in this country.
Right. I mean, there was this big yellow peril. There was this big scare about how many Chinese were coming here. So I had no idea that at the time, Chinese restaurants were considered a scandalous place. Going out on a chop suey date and going to a chop suey restaurant was considered akin to like going
scandalous?
To a rave. I talked to UC Davis law professor Gabriel Jack Chin, who you actually met, Nyla.
Yeah, I did. I met him in Champaign.
And he told me that it was a place of freedom, a place where women who were about to get the vote nationally, had already gotten in Chicago, felt like they did not have to necessarily follow the rest of the laws of society.
And they went to Chinese restaurants to do that?
Yes. So if you wanted to be free from the strict laws of society at that time, you went to a Chinese restaurant.
Just seems so crazy.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I mean, these are racist laws, basically saying that no Chinaman, quote unquote, could get a restaurant license, or that white women under the age of 21 years old couldn't enter one of these restaurants. Clearly, there was racism involved. But I do want to say that at the time, Chicago's Chinatowns were located near the Levee districts or the red light districts. And some of them did have ties to bars.
And there were a lot of Chinese gangs.
There were Chinese gangs, and opium was an issue in Chicago, not just in Chinese areas, but I will give that caveat. It didn't mean that you needed to bar any Chinese from ever getting a restaurant
license. It
didn't
mean that every chop suey restaurant was a drug haven.
Exactly. Although you can hear this sentiment when you listen to Louis Prima's song, Chop Suey Chow Mein, Tu Fu and You.
Chop suey chow mein, tu fu and you. I've got the craziest yen to get you in a Chinese den, where I can whisper love words full of spice after we get full of tea and rice. Chop suey chow mein, tu fu and you. I've got a feeling tonight that we'll be pretty clever if we ever get together with chop suey chow mein, rice and tea, shoes and rice, and you and me. Chop suey chow mein, young one, tu fu and you.
But then, later in that century, in 1915, after tons of case law had been established, after tons of, and you know there's this connection between the Chinese and the Jews, they love each other, but a lot of Jewish immigration lawyers had been working toward changing the rules about Chinese immigration. And there were four
categories. Why?
Well, because the Chinese wanted to keep coming in, and so they kept...
They were helping.
They were helping out. They were immigration lawyers. So there were four categories of people who would be allowed in under the Chinese Exclusion Act: students, diplomats, teachers, and merchants. But in terms of interpreting what a merchant meant, it was very, very loose. And initially, it did not include restaurant owners. But after tons of tries and after a lot of case law was established, finally in 1915, they established beyond a shadow of a doubt that a high-class Chinese restaurateur could gain entrance to the United States and actually go back and bring relatives. What would we call chain migration today?
But it was really expensive, quote unquote, yeah, chain migration.
Right. So you would have to show that you had a certain class of restaurant, and you had to have three white witnesses vouch for you, saying that you truly were the manager of the restaurant, that you did no menial tasks, you were not a worker.
And how much would it have cost in today's dollars to do this?
You know, I was seeing some estimates of about $100,000, $130,000 per restaurant.
Okay.
And so I was also told that, you know, different immigration judges would be more lenient or less lenient depending on who you went to. But it was, you know, pretty much established you had to have a nice place or else you couldn't come in. And then, of course, you know, the three white witnesses rule that they had to vouch.
White men, I'm sure.
Right.
I'm sure it wasn't white women.
But once that happened, and once they said, okay, restaurateur is a category that will be let in and can go back and get workers, you saw a tripling of Chinese restaurants. Sometimes you saw a fivefold increase of Chinese restaurants in different communities. But you didn't want them all in the same community. So then you saw Chinese going to Oklahoma. I have some family who are out there, going to the South, going everywhere because you didn't want to have a ton of competition. So Chinese restaurants were spread out all over the United States, and everybody decided that they were a restaurateur now.
We didn't make a dent in this food. Not even, barely. It was good, though.
A lot of Eggfu Young left for Louisa.
Thank you for a lovely dinner, Louisa Chu, Monica Ng. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Now it's time to finish this chop suey.
We're not going to finish it. Now it's time to pack it all up and take it home.
Take out boxes.
Special thanks to Monica Ng, Louisa Chu, Lee's Chop Suey, and Robin Lin for producing that segment. We'll be back after a quick break here on the 21st.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. We're so glad to see so many of you lovely people here tonight. We would especially like to welcome all the representatives of Illinois' law enforcement community who have chosen to join us here in the Palace Hotel Ballroom at this time. We certainly hope you all enjoy the show. And remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there's still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody.
That, of course, is from the 1980 film The Blues Brothers. Thanks for tuning in to this encore edition of The 21st. That's an iconic Illinois movie, and it's also the winner of an online poll put out by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. They put out a project called Top 200 to celebrate our state's 200th birthday, and they've created 20 top 10 lists for residents to vote on. In this movie contest, Blues Brothers came out on top. Back in March, we spoke with two of our friends from the Lincoln Library and Museum. Chris Wills is their communications director. Christian McWhorter is a research historian. We started by asking Chris to explain what the museum's doing to celebrate the bicentennial.
The state is celebrating its 200th birthday, obviously, so we thought it would be great to give the public a chance to speak out on what they consider the 200 top things and people and places and events in history. So we created a website, IllinoisTop200.com, and every 2 weeks people can vote on what they consider to be the top movies in Illinois history, or the most important influential businesses, or the top books and scholars, inventors, politicians. And at the end of the year, they'll have selected 200 people, places, and things that they think are the best in state history.
Right. So non and then historic sites, actors, writers, lots of things to celebrate Illinois and our state. So, Christian, let's get into the movies that were part of the poll. Any surprise that the Blues Brothers came out on top?
Probably not. I mean, I'm not from here. I grew up in Canada, and the Blues Brothers was probably the first time I ever saw Chicago or Illinois was watching that movie as a kid.
You know what? I think I was probably the same for me.
Yeah,
I think it was the same thing for me, too, because I didn't grow up in Illinois. I grew up in Miami, and I think I thought Dan Aykroyd was probably Chicago and Illinois when I was a kid.
Right, and he's from Canada, too, right? So there you go.
Oh, no. All right. Well, Christian, we already know this movie was set in Chicago. I wonder if you, and Chris, you can hop in after this, but what do you think this impact of the film was when it came out in 1980 and then after that?
Well, I can tell you one of the things was it really exposed a lot of people to the music the Blues Brothers were covering. A lot of those songs had gone out of print, and it kind of created this impression of Chicago as a place where the blues kind of thrived and got introduced to the world, which is really true and is something Illinois and Chicago should really be proud of.
Chris, do you remember the first time you saw the Blues Brothers?
Yeah, I do. And I remember at the time thinking it was really dumb. All these car crashes and driving through a mall, and these guys kind of, if not ripping off, at least sort of capitalizing on classic music. But as time has gone on, I've really grown to appreciate its charms. Yes, it's silly and cartoonish in a way, but it really has a heart. You know, it's about these two guys who are pretty shady, but they're trying to do the right thing. And that's kind of Illinois' image in the world, so it seems very fitting.
Kind of shady, but has a heart.
Trying to do the right thing, you know?
Well, number three on this list is A League of Their Own. And a reminder for everyone, this came out in 1992. At the time, the very A-list stars of Gina Davis, Madonna, and, of course, Tom Hanks. Let's take a listen to A League of Their Own.
Say, Evelyn. Can I ask you a question? You got a moment?
Mm-hmm.
Which team do you play for?
Well, I'm a peach.
Well, I was just wondering, because I couldn't figure out why you would throw home when we've got a 2-run lead. You let the tying run get on second, and we lost the lead because of you. Now you start using your head. That's that love that's 3 feet above your ass. Are you crying?
No.
Are you crying? Are you crying? There's no crying. There's no crying in baseball.
That's A League of Their Own. That was, of course, Tom Hanks playing a baseball team manager yelling at Betty Schramm. The movie's actually about the real-life All-American Girls Pro Baseball League. Christian, what do you think the significance of A League of Their Own is? Because at the time, it was really, I think, groundbreaking, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely, in that not only did it highlight something that was, like, specifically women's history, but I think the women's league in the 1940s had been all but forgotten. And so it just led to this huge revival of interest in this, I mean, really cool women's sports story. And, I mean, there's just not that many movies about women in sports out there, right? Still.
Yeah, there still aren't. That's a good point. And Chris, I think there's no crying in baseball. It's kind of one of those pop culture lines that's just stuck around, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's on one of those lists that they do every so often of the top this or that in movies. It's considered one of the top 100 quotes in movie history. So it's really stuck around.
And in that clip, Betty Schramm's wearing a team jersey with a badge that says Rockford. Christian, can you remind us of the movie in terms of Illinois, where that's set?
Yeah, they're the Rockford Peaches in Rockford, Illinois, just, you know, west of Chicago. So a true Illinois story.
Okay. Now let's move on to a certain Illinois movie that I'm going to guess is the most well-known in this illustrious list. It came in second after this online poll. Let's just go ahead and hear it.
Adamson.
Here.
Adler.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Bueller. 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 Bueller.
He's sick. My best friend's sister's boyfriend's brother's girlfriend heard from this guy who knows this kid is going with the girl who saw Ferris pass out at 31 Flavors last night. I guess it's pretty serious.
Thank you, Simone.
That, of course, is Ferris Bueller's Day Off, starring Matthew Broderick. If for some reason you've never heard of this, it's about a kid who pretends to be sick so he can skip school and have a dream day with his friends in downtown Chicago. I'm talking to Chris Wills and Christian McWhorter from the Lincoln Museum and Library. Chris, what are your memories of this, of Ferris Bueller?
Just the ingenuity and daring of Bueller in his escapades, trying to figure out how to fake a day off, how to get away from school. So it really symbolized somebody who was smart and daring enough to do what they wanted to do. And then, of course, it showed off Chicago. It made it seem like such a great wonderland to wander around in and see all these different sights and take part in all these different activities.
And I remember a couple of years ago, there was a really great Twitter account that was pretending to be Ferris and was recreating his whole day and taking pictures of the whole day. And I think it kind of brought back for everybody how much they love about this film. So Christian, I'm going to need you to defend the honor of this movie here, because part of the reason this came in second place in your poll is because Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune did some of his own online lobbying to make sure it didn't win. It is all in good fun. He is not a fan of this movie. He wasn't able to make it today to come on the 21st, but he did leave us his voicemail explaining his thoughts about Ferris Bueller.
Hey guys, Michael Phillips here at the Chicago Tribune. My hometown is Kenosha, Wisconsin, but you know, what can I do about that? I'm calling about the whole debate about what is really Illinois' top movie. And you know, the fact that Blues Brothers beat out Ferris Bueller's Day Off, I guess that's a good thing. I do prefer that movie, but it's got to be something like either Call Northside 777 with James Stewart, or Haskell Wexler's Medium Cool, or really my favorite of the ones that were nominated, His Girl Friday, which was filmed in, of course, Burbank, California, not anywhere near Chicago. But it is the greatest of the adaptations of The Front Page, which is the quintessential Chicago play, and that was the best film version of it. So I would vote His Girl Friday, but, you know, I can live with the Blues Brothers. I would not have been able to live with Ferris Bueller had that won. I would have had to move back to Kenosha.
All right, that's Michael Phillips, the Chicago Tribune's film critic, giving us his list of Illinois movies. Christian, why is Michael wrong about Ferris Bueller?
Well, I love Michael Phillips. I really do. It's an honor to be even virtually on a show with him.
It's okay. I'm trying to start a fight between you two, as you can see.
He's absolutely totally right that Ferris Bueller is a movie about, like, kind of an adolescent jerk being an adolescent jerk. And my defense of it is it was at precisely, like, when it came out, I was at the right age to be, you know, an adolescent jerk. And so it was like a perfect movie for, like, someone of that age to, like, see. And just, it's a power fantasy for, like, a high school kid, right? And it really plays well that way. I think it has more heart than he gives it credit for. But yeah, I've got a real soft spot for it. I loved that movie, girl. I loved all John Hughes' movies. But, yeah, Ferris Bueller is kind of a cut above. So that's the best I can do to try to defend it. And it makes Chicago look awesome, right? I tell you, I didn't live here at the time, and that movie made me want to go to Chicago and see it. It looks like a great place.
Yeah, no, I'll agree with you on that. Chris, one of the movies Michael Phillips mentioned is called His Girl Friday. This came out in 1940. I know you were talking to our producers earlier with your personal favorites. You had His Girl Friday on your list. What do you like about that?
Well, I'm a former reporter, so this is a movie about reporters chasing a story, doing anything for the headlines, and in the process trying to keep a poor guy from being executed for a crime. So it's fun. The comedy is great. It's the fastest paced movie ever because the dialogue is so fast, and it just captures such a wonderful Chicago flavor. So it's just always been a favorite of mine. It's really worth seeing. And you know, I would like to respond to one thing that Michael Phillips said. Is Blues Brothers the best movie about Illinois? Is Ferris Bueller's Day Off the second best? No. But we're asking people what the top movies are, and we're letting them define that however they want. Maybe it's the one that seems most quintessentially Illinois to them. Maybe it's the one that means the most to them on a personal level. So I don't think we have to think of it as best. We can just think of it as the tops, the one that the people of Illinois like the most.
Or we could think of it as popular versus what a film critic would
pick. Too.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. All right. So before we end, we're almost out of time, but we have, Christian, your personal favorite that you sent us, 16 Candles by John Hughes.
It's a brand new year. I'm 16. Everything should be platinum. I should be happy, right? Right?
Yeah.
Well, I can't get happy. It is physically impossible for me to get happy.
Christian, you mentioned John Hughes earlier. Why do you think that John Hughes for you represents sort of a lot of this iconic popular Illinois?
It's funny, you know, his movies, they're all set in Chicago, although Chris, I think, pointed out earlier that there's a lot of them could be set anywhere, but the fact that they are all in Chicago, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, I don't know, they kind of touch on a kind of universal experience of what it was to be a teenager or, you know, growing up in the 80s. And there's a lot about 16 Candles that is not defensible at this point. But
right, yeah, especially at this point, yeah.
It hits, yeah, Long Duck Dong especially, yes, it's not defensible at all. But and The Breakfast Club is surely a better movie. But again, I'm just, you know, as like Chris said, we're talking about favorites here, movies that had an emotional, you know, resonance for you. And I was at just that right age for, like, John Hughes movies to really hit me in the sweet spot. And they really, you know, reflect what it was like to be a white, you know, middle-class person growing up in the 80s. And they'll always have a little special place in my heart.
Well, we've got the whole list. We'll tweet out that whole list for everybody. If you're looking for something to watch this weekend, I want to thank Chris Wills. He's the communications director at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Christian McWhorter, research historian. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thanks for having us.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app,
Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.